This is Scott. I'm going to try to dial in. I'm going to try to dial in from my desktop. I couldn't do that in the breakout room, so I'm going to do it right now.
Okay, sure. Let me introduce Scott, and let me also introduce Ed Rowley. They are the co-writers of the case. Ed, welcome to Seat at the Table. Nice to see you. So Scott Fitzgerald is the managing partner of the Boston office of a law firm called Fragerman and managing director of Fragerman Immigration Services in India. Scott, would you mind putting yourselves on mute? Because what I'm hearing is feedback. So please put yourselves on mute. Scott is a board member of the American Immigration Council and the British American Business Council of New England. He's the founding member of the Council for Emerging National Security Affairs and the Massachusetts Business Immigration Coalition. Scott is a graduate of Johns Hopkins University and Fordham University Law School. Ed is a partner at Fragerman Firm. His practice focuses on cross-border and U.S. immigration disputes. He has spent more than a decade counseling individuals and corporations in highly regulated communities. Ed received his JD from Georgetown University Law Center and his BA from Washington College. So welcome to you both. Let's go to the different groups. First is the group with Amita, Ed Marsh, Ed Rowley, Steve Barnett, and Vera Tice. Do you have a spokesperson?
Me.
So please speak up, Vera.
Okay. All right. So in terms of the company with the problem, I guess we summarize the two facts or what we don't know, the two main points. One is that we have undocumented workers that are not authorized to work in the U.S., and that has been verified. The second issue is we don't know if senior management knew this when they brought them on board. So that's unverified. So undocumented, unauthorized to work in the U.S. is verified, but not verified is whether senior management knew about this. In terms of what paths the company could take, there's three. They could continue to use those workers to pick the berries and not tell anyone or report the undocumented workers. Second, they could inform the government that they became aware that they are having undocumented workers there, but that they're going to do an investigation with the intent of having the workers continue and try and negotiate that with the government. The third alternative would be just have the workers pick the berries and don't tell anybody and hope you don't get caught. So that's what we came up as the three. In terms of what we as a group decided would be best for the CEO and the board to support would be inform the government, tell them that you're bringing in a third-party firm to investigate fully, but you believe that these are undocumented workers, but you don't know anything beyond that in terms of whether people at the company were aware of it when they brought them on. Try and negotiate that while this investigation is going on, that the workers can continue to pick the berry. And then in addition, in parallel with this, we had advised that the company hires a PR crisis management firm to handle any type of communications that gets out, any news, and also hire the appropriate lawyers, as it mentioned, criminal and immigration, to review the situation. And also to review the current D&O insurance for the board. Things just to keep in mind as we were making this decision is that the board has a fiduciary responsibility. However, it's not just about, what's at risk is losing $15 million in revenue. The other things that is very obvious is that there's a huge reputational risk because this is one of the big 10 farms and it is a major part of the food supply and it's a public company. So reputation impact could be huge. And also potentially having hefty penalties and criminal charges is significant as well and would grossly impact the company. So that's the path we would take. And those are the recommendations that we would take as a board, and we would support the CEO in moving forward with that plan.
Thank you very much. The next group is with Ingrid, Jim, Marianne, and Scott. You have a spokesperson. Can you unmute
yourself, please? Larry, it's me. I just unmuted myself. Our analysis is not much different than Vera's. While the facts of the case don't support it, are silent on it. It is somewhat mildly incredible that the board is at least not aware of the potential of these sorts of issues. Employment in agriculture is, all of us on the team have nothing to do with agriculture, but it's something we were all familiar with. It's clear that they were working, it seems like they were working around this issue with the subcontractor. The reaction to the subcontractor firing a bunch of people and then the company getting involved and working around that is clearly a significant risk. The most senior person in the organization that can be shown tied to that's probably got to go. Dealing with your legal team as the first thing to do to develop a plan to get to ICE and figure out what you can do with that. Clearly need a crisis communication activity, and you've got to figure out a way to helicopter in a management team to help clean up this mess. Maybe you've got some clever lawyers, and we have no idea as a team how sympathetic ICE is to situations like this and whether one can negotiate with them. Hopefully your legal team can help you with that. This is an area where I suspect that the board is exposed from a DNO point. They're exposed on a bunch of different levels because it seems like at least they should at least been aware of the potential for it and having procedures in place to make sure that employment practices are reasonable is something that a board in this side of sort of industry should probably be paying attention to. And it's silent on whether or not it has come up, but that was kind of our comment relative to that. So I guess the only other issue we had was kind of a comment at the end is, which may be something to discuss with the crisis communication team. If you really can't find people to pick the fruit, an issue of looking for volunteers and putting the food, using the fruit to go to food banks and other sorts of things might be a way to salvage some reputation out of a crisis. So that was one of the things that we didn't develop well, but that was kind of one of the other points we had. So that's probably, if I missed anything, Ingrid or Marianne?
No, I would just raise the point that I'm not certain that if the board can be found complicit, the DNO insurance wouldn't cover the board. The board has either got to be terribly naive and not doing their job, or they would have been complicit, and that's a risk.
I think the board is probably individually exposed, but as I agree with that, Marianne. Is there a hand there that Ingrid? Were you? Oh, no, that's not a hand. It was my cursor standing. It looked like a hand on Ingrid's box, but it was just my cursor. Sorry.
Okay. Thanks very much. Next group is Alexander, Greg, Jim, and Stephen.
Okay, so this is Craig. I'll give the summary. Yeah, we concur with the previous two groups that we've got to disclose. One thing that wasn't clear, you know, it talks about the CEO wants the support of the board, but it doesn't tell us what position he or she is taking. So one thing that we wanted to do at the outset is find out what the CEO's position is. What, you know, is he or she, I'll just use he for now, what's his thought? And if it is to sort of sweep it under the rug and just pick and forget and hope nothing happens, we were not comfortable with that and would strongly recommend that he be replaced. There are a number of points of liability here. There's obviously potential fees, fines from ICE and the Department of Labor. There are legal fees to defend, shareholder suits potentially, lost clients, adverse publicity, reputational risk, obviously, impact on share price, and obviously personal liability for the directors. So, you know, all in all, we just don't feel that, you know, hiding this and not being forthcoming is wise. On the contrary, we think that being forthcoming might at least put us in somewhat, I don't want to say good graces, but less bad graces with the ICE and those folks. And we just take our lumps. We recommend an audit of the senior managers. We don't know how much upper management knew, so they might be able to claim negligence. Although, as has been pointed out in this business, how can one not know this kind of stuff might go on? We don't know what the impact of the $15 million is. Is this a significant sum for a company, the company, to the point where it might put them in, potentially Chapter 11? Or something like that. We tend not to think so, but we don't know that. And if it is, then we have to have some kind of a, perhaps maybe a stock repurchase or some other activity. But again, aligned with everybody else, we just don't think it's a good practice to keep this quiet, and we want to be forthcoming and forthright and upfront. Jim, Alex, Steve, anything you want to add?
No, I think that covers it. Thanks.
Yeah, that was very good. Maybe the notification to the insurance company about the situation on the D&O policy.
Yep. Last group, Ari, Babs, Barry, Brian, and John.
Okay, I'm the speaker for our group. You kidnapped us in the middle of a sentence, so I'll just finish my sentence for the group. The moral of the story is that sometime the benefit of the product is not in the functionality, but in the emotional benefit it gives to the customers. Now to the case, like all the other groups, we agreed we cannot not report it. We have to report it. However, we should move in parallel paths and take the time to investigate, first of all. Maybe it's a false, whether the whistleblower had some hidden agenda or whatever. So we need to take the time to investigate before we report, and then report to the government, not rush into reporting to the government before we investigate it internally, so we can demonstrate that we did not ignore it, we did not try to cover up, but we took the time to investigate. We identified three, there is the risk of the money, losing the money from not picking up the fruits on time and losing customers. So that's the risk we have to take into account here. There are three fronts. One is coming clean with the government. The other one, prepare a crisis public relations announcement. And the third one is the risk of being sued by shareholders in case it caused some crash in the share price in the stock market. Anything else I missed, Tim?
Yeah, there were two things that some people said. One was that this might be, because the complaint went to their whistleblower site and didn't go straight to ICE, it's kind of a little suspicious. So could this actually be a play on the stock price or someone trying to damage the company's reputation? So is it a real, you know, it's not that it isn't real, but it's very suspicious that somebody didn't go straight to ICE. And could it be that? The other thing we talked about was that there's a big difference between having undocumented workers and having people who have stolen identities, and that it appears that their contractors and employees might be involved in much more than just getting workers to work that aren't documented to. And it's notable that the attorney contacted both a criminal and an immigration lawyer because the seriousness of the stolen identities and what could be behind that is far, far, far more serious than having documented workers. And it could be part of a larger system that is not just about this farm, that there's, you know, maybe somebody's actually bringing people over the border and, you know, this is a bigger thing than just this. So there's all those possibilities.
Thank you. Thank you very, and thank you very much, everybody else. Let's turn this over to Scott and Ed. And I understand that this is a real case, but the industry was disguised. Ed, Scott, you want to take?
Yeah, I want to kick off and I'll turn it over to the experts. So I used to do this stuff. I've been with the firm a very long time, about 32 years, but I do what's called business immigration and help big companies get work permits for their foreign national employees. But Eddie is still involved and very much involved in this type of work. I did this type of work back in the early 90s, and we were extremely busy. And then Bill Clinton became president, and they made a decision, and I don't have a big problem with it, to turn down enforcement significantly. And that resulted, you know, I think it contributed to an economic stimulus, let's put it that way. But it, you know, it would be very, very, very controversial today. So this stuff does come up. I'm going to turn it over to Eddie, and then I took some notes about knowledge and what's reasonable and what a board member would potentially know. But I'm going to turn it over to Eddie.
So thanks, Scott. I'll start by, I think, running through the answers to some of the questions that were asked, and then getting into some of the specifics. So in this particular case, the CEO's position was to disclose. That position was being challenged by subordinates who also had significant influence with the board, which is why it became a board issue. Because while, as someone asked, would this cause the company Chapter 11? No, but it would have significantly cut into a very powerful senior VP's division's profits for the purposes, and probably made that one end up in the red for the financial year at issue. As with all these cases, so I think a lot of people, you know, said there's a lot of information you don't know, that was by design. Obviously, a longer investigation ensued, and we can talk more about that. But at the outset, this was the very basic information that went to the C-suite and ultimately up to the board for a decision, because it was a very quick reaction to information that was received and a response that had to take place. As for controls, in real life, the company did have some reasonable controls for its industry. And one of those being the ethics hotline itself, which was a powerful piece of information that we used when the disclosure ultimately did occur. So how the company proceeded here was with a short initial disclosure that these workers were there, that they were unauthorized. And to Babs's point, there were indications that some of these people had procured false identities, which does turn the seriousness of the issue up quite a bit. To keep the hypothetical simpler, we didn't add that here, but it does significantly turn up the heat because it means that somebody is engaged in a crime that carries a mandatory minimum under federal penalties. As far as did the company disclose the manager's knowledge? The answer is yes. It was disclosed very early. Local managers knew about certain conduct. What the extent of that knowledge was, you know, remained to be seen at that point. As far as mentioning the executives, we said this goes up possibly as high as X at this point, but we need to substantiate that information and come back with a more thorough report in the end. The managers, local management, the company did send in what I think was described here as a helicopter team, but they parachuted a number of managers in from other locations where these issues were not happening in order to gain control over the workforce and see. ICE was willing to work with the company because they were particularly interested. And by the way, we made the disclosure to the U.S. Attorney's Office and to ICE sort of simultaneously. That's how it works. But the ICE was willing to work with the company for a couple of reasons. First, everybody recognizes that you can't terminate a bunch of people all at the same time and still run a business. Now, that depends upon the presidential administration. This actually happened during the Trump administration, which, as many people probably know, was could be seen as very anti-immigrant, but it was also very pro-business. And so it's about appealing, you know, making the appeal in the right way to the right people, and having, you know, conversations that make sense. Also, there were plans that were interrupted by COVID to make arrests of the individuals who had procured false identities. And so the government wanted those people in one place. So there was an interest in allowing them to continue to work while the process of, you know, putting all of the pieces in place to do that safely for both the people, the agents, and frankly, the company. The company did engage a crisis management team with experience in the particular location, which here we're using Ohio. I'm not saying that that's where this happened, but in the area where it happened, who also knew Washington and also knew Republican politics, because that was going to be an important thing. They planned for both the before disclosure was made, they planned for the if ICE just went out and did a raid, and then they subsequently planned for bad press if it ever came to that. They hired lawyers. We were retained to do an invasive and complete review of, you know, who knew what and when, including full document reviews. Questions were about, you know, having the board have those same lawyers review certain things. Because of the involvement of someone as high up as the president of a division, the board retained its own lawyers ultimately. And they had their lawyers review their D&O insurance and formed an audit committee, used a portion of the audit committee to form a special committee of the board to oversee those attorneys. I believe they did notify their insurance carrier, but I was not counsel on that. I'm sure they did, though, given the lawyers they hired. And then they had a combination of those lawyers, and then the company's securities lawyers did a formal analysis of whether the $15 million constituted a material information that had to be disclosed. In this particular instance, as I mentioned, it was not, but they did do that. They had the lawyers do that analysis. I'll tell you one other fact that we looked for that no one asked about is kids, child labor, which is another very, very complicating factor that we looked at to see whether it came into play. And there was no indications that it did there. I've had other cases where it does. No one brought up this idea of volunteers picking the fruit. I actually love that. I'll tell you why. And Scott maybe knew this, but the people themselves who you would have to terminate, to the extent that they were not arrested in a raid, they could actually come back and pick the fruit as a volunteer, because the law only prohibits you from employing them for labor, for remuneration. So if they pick the fruit for free to take it home or take it to their local food bank, that's not illegal. But I've never heard that before, but I'm going to put it in the repertoire of things that we could suggest. So Scott, I don't know if I've covered the basic outlines of what you wanted me to, but.
No, I think that's great. If I can just add a couple of things and then we can turn it over to questions. So there was a comment that senior management didn't know. And actually there's a line in there that says that the regional president may have known. And that's relevant to Ari's comment about due diligence. Like maybe we got to go, if that's a big issue, maybe we got to go figure out whether this regional president really did know or did not know, and it's material to how we're going to proceed. I think there's a misperception.
Did not, by the way.
Did not. There you go.
I think there's smoke, no fire.
misperception about, let's talk about a broad knowledge. There's this program called E-Verify, and E-Verify is a system by which they run the Social Security number, date of birth, and they determine whether or not somebody is in the United States lawfully and authorized to work. And lots of people steal those identities, right? So they'll get a hold of somebody's Social Security number and name, and they will use a false document, but a real number. And sometimes you find out about this when someone, you know, gets a notification that they owe taxes on a job that they never had. One of the things that back in the day, Eddie, you can tell me if they still do this, but we used to go and check for return W-2s. We'd go to a company and say, do you frequently get W-2 forms that are undeliverable to the address that isn't in your records? And they'll say, oh yeah, there's a whole box of them over there. And it's because the people have utilized a false identity. The stock price piece and this idea that someone's trying to manipulate it, you will frequently see that the reason that a informant doesn't go to ICE is because they are also not authorized to work in the United States. So they may have some kind of a lover's quarrel or whatever you want to call it, and all of a sudden they're, you know, contacting somebody to cause all kinds of trouble, but they themselves need to be anonymous and you know, not working at that company. These issues are not as front and center, and there is some defense to that. I'll give you two examples. I gave one to my breakout group many years ago, probably 1994, when I was a young associate. There was a big fanfare around a really well-known major food conglomerate buying a bagel factory in Brooklyn. And I remember that Rudy Giuliani went out and cut the ribbon, and there was a big ceremony. It was on the news. And then shortly thereafter, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Immigration Service, and the IRS all investigated simultaneously this bagel factory. And we were retained along with criminal counsel. And I went out there, and I walked in, and you know, no one spoke English. Okay, that's not that big a deal. I started asking questions about return W-2s, and it turned out at the end of this, so we would literally sit with the employees, myself and criminal counsel, and ask them about their situation. And there are laws that protect people from being asked about their immigration status. And you can be fined for discrimination, right? You can't use immigration to discriminate against a potential or current worker. This all bets were off, right? We're getting investigated by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Like, all bets are off. We need to find out what our exposure is. And we figured out that I think it was, you know, 85 or 90% of the workforce was unauthorized to work in the United States. And I can't remember. I think it was the 7 train that I would take out to Brooklyn. We'd have these interviews, and then I'd ride the train back with all the guys who got fired. It was a little awkward, but they were very nice. And that was just so the folks who did the deal, the senior executives at that major conglomerate, got fired. I mean, they just didn't catch this issue. And that was a major problem. A similar situation, not related to unauthorized employment, but immigration front and center, and you know, very smart people miss it. I was personally involved in the case a couple of years back here in Massachusetts. A company announces a new CEO, very excited, lots of fanfare, super talented gentleman. And then they figure out that he can't work for the company because his visa status is tied to his prior employer. And there's no way for us to help. Like we couldn't come up with a mechanism to facilitate that. And he, you know, they had to like pretty quietly say that, oh, he's decided not to join the company. So that's very similar, like somebody missed it, right? They do all this due diligence and they missed that very key component. So it's not always as simple as one would think. The one piece that I did that came up, you know, should the board have known? I don't know, you know, maybe, but you know what? The board or someone should have known that that contractor, that company that they had outsourced all this staffing to, they didn't have a contract anymore. Well, if they don't have a contract anymore, like who's doing the work and who's the new contractor? And if there's no new contractor, where did they suddenly find all these workers? So I think that is an issue that someone in the C-suite should have caught that. And inform the board and figure this out before somebody, filed or reached out to the hotline. So that's all I have, Eddie.
The hotline and the board not knowing.
Any questions, please raise your hand.
Oh, sorry,
Larry. Larry, you froze. Oh, Larry wants to know if anybody has a question. Can you raise your hand?
Doesn't look like it.
Yeah. My internet connection. Yeah.
Ed Rolla, you were gonna say something when Larry asked his question. You had.
Yeah, Eddie,
raise your hand.
Hey, Eddie, can you hear us?
I can.
Yeah, you just want to finish up your comment you were making?
Oh no, I was just gonna say that these issues are often not at the board level. The information on day-to-day, you know, whether there should have been more controls in place, all of that gets revisited in the wake of something like this. But I think in reality, workforce compliance at the low levels is often very far divorced from what happens in a C-suite. And that is, you know, it's why I'm employed. You know, I wouldn't have a job otherwise.
No, it's not true. Not true.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment. This is a very engaging case. I get on a lot of these calls every month, and this is probably one of the more engaging cases I've heard. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. One thing to point out, Marianne, before we go, the reason that I restructured this and changed the facts a little bit, I grew up in Western Michigan and Wisconsin, and I hate Ohio State. So I decided that
they were the bad guy.
So there you go.
Great.
Ingrid. Wow. Sorry. You understand. You probably hate Wisconsin and Michigan. So there you go. It's all good. All good. Go Big Ten. Go Big Ten.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. And thank you, Eddie, for the case. And I think it was a very interesting case, and it sparked a lot of conversation and debate. It's 20 after 6. Larry is not going to be coming back, but I just want to let you know that we will be having a meeting the last week in August, and we'll be sending out information for you all. And I just want to thank you all for attending and participating so vigorously. And again, thank our case presenters, because it was a really good case and we really appreciate it.
It was. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Eddie, really appreciate it.
Thanks. I enjoyed talking with you all.
Bye. Good night, everyone. Hi, Larry. Oh, he's not there. Oh, there you are. Everybody's gone. Jim's still here. It was good.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Thank you.
Scott, this is Larry Steibel. I am so sorry. My internet connection just died. I couldn't get back on. Thank you very much for this case. Thanks very much for the discussion. I think people got really into it, and I want to thank you. And I look forward to talking with you in August. Hey, Eddie, this is Larry Steibel. To the Zoom program, but this was great. You could clearly see people were involved with it. And you know, your explanation was terrific. It was great. Well, thank you for the table programs. We'll put you on the email list. You take care. Enjoy the summer. Bye bye.
Yeah.